Buddhist Society Summer School, 1979. Phyllis Mehta gives answers to questions on Wednesday afternoon, the 5th of September.
I am new to the teachings of Buddhism, and the doctrine of anatta is perplexing. No God, no soul. Would you please explain what is buddhi and what is the connecting link between the ultimate reality and the psychophysical being? Perhaps in the course of this talk, the latter part has been answered already. The first part, the doctrine of anatta is perplexing, no God, no soul. Bear in mind that the word atta in Pali is the equivalent of the word atma in Sanskrit. Now, the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads particularly spoke about the Atma as the Absolute. They also spoke about Brahman as the Absolute, the one total reality. Two words. There are two words because the fundamental questions which man has asked for thousands of years now are these. What is ultimate reality? And the next question, who am I? The first is an objectively structured question. What is the ultimate reality? The next question is subjectively presented. Who am I? Now those people made no investigations because they hadn't the means in those days, partly, and they were not. It wasn't the age when investigation of such questions could take place in more modernistic, analytical, intellectual, psychological, experimental terms. Now, the old Upanishadic teachers, all the great Vedic seers, the holy ones, in attempting to answer those questions, they had to start, of course, in the ordinary external way of thinking, as we call it, looking outwards in trying to answer what is ultimate reality, and looking inwards in order to answer who am I. But before long, if one proceeds along one or the other line, you find that the two questions have merged into one, and that you are answering them in terms of the changes of your states of consciousness. As you cast aside veil after veil of thoughts and ideas and feelings, impressions, so-called intuitions and so forth. So you see, the actual process is a process of the complete denudation of the psyche. It is empty. And then, in that peaceful, quiet state, as we were talking about a few minutes ago, in that state, they realized the peak point to which man can possibly go. And in answering the objective question, what, they said they used the word Brahman. Brahman is derived from brih. Brih meaning to expand, and man is mind. You see? The expansion of the mind. But it was no longer a case of the expansion of my mind, as we refer to it. It was the complete denudation of the psyche, the the functioning of universal mind through that psychophysical organism then, you see, and it had expanded to include the total reality. And that was a state of utter oneness. It was a unitary wholeness of consciousness. A unitary wholeness. There was no differentiation at all. The undifferentiated primordial consciousness. In answering the question, who am I, they looked within themselves, which involved in the first stages their psychological knowledge and so forth, and the examination of the psyche and so forth. And then as that quietened down, they found that the same process which occurred when answering what is ultimate reality was taking place in answering who am I. And they ended up with one word, Atma. Again, A-T-M-A-N. Atma. Man. Man, mind. And At, the root, means to eat up. Very, very significant. One's personal mind, as we may say, certainly one's whole psyche, through the denudation process, is being eaten up by the realization in consciousness of the ultimate truth, of the supreme truth. Hence, they used the two words, Brahman and Atma. But then note what happened. They made this extraordinary statement. A super genius to be able to do this kind of thing. They said Brahman and Atma are identical. They didn't say they are a not-two-ness. They said they are an identity. And they added afterwards, absolute consciousness, pure consciousness is Brahman Atma. Now, I've tried to put it in a few words as succinctly as I could. I think all of you can sort of get the general feel of it, the general structure of this presentation. You see? So, Brahman, Atma, absolute consciousness were an identity as such. And that is the meaning of Atma, which is propounded in the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads. Prajapati, the great teacher, says to Indra and Virochana when they come to him as pupils, he says to them, the Atma which is birthless, unaging, undecaying, deathless, sorrowless, stainless, it is that which you should seek, not ask these simple questions. It is that which you should seek. That is how it is put by Prajapati, and the name Prajapati means Lord of Creatures. It's an extraordinary thing how these people took on their names. Look at the biblical names. Elijah, God Himself. Elisha, God the Savior. And so on. But they are all within your own individual being, because there is no separate person called God away from you, outside you. We do say in Him we live and move and have our being. So it is you yourself who, transcending all the limitations upon awareness because of our drawbacks, ultimately realize that state. And Elijah and Elisha are one and the same. And note also how Elijah performs miracles like Jesus did. Brings that baby back to life and so forth. It's a most fascinating thing how those old people gave these forms. So the name is important. Prajapati, the Lord of Creatures, gives this instruction. The Buddha, in that famous autobiographical discourse, the Ariya Pariyesana Sutta, Then, O bhikkhus, seeking the unborn, the uttermost security from the bonds, Nibbana, I won the unborn, the uttermost security of the bonds, from the bonds, Nibbana. Having said that, he proceeds to the unaging, the undecaying, the undying, the sorrowless, the stainless. This is represented by the word Atta. Now, how different is the Atta from Atma in its true original meaning? The Buddha was very well acquainted, perfectly acquainted, with all the profound spiritual teachings of the day. How different was it? Hardly any. In fact, none at all. Now, how did this anatta come in? I mentioned this afternoon Yajnavalkya saying, neti, neti, the transcendent is not this, not this, not this. The not this refers to everything which is existential, belongs to the context of the finite, the limited, the mortal, subject to uprising, proceeding, ending, to birth, growth, death. It lies in the context of mortality. Neti, neti. But transcendence, that state of awareness which goes right beyond the limitations of finitude and mortality, is the indescribable, the nondescript, the unthinkable, unimaginable. Because all thought and all imagination is finite. Isn't that so? So now, supposing we do see clearly that anatta means not the context of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. And what is not that context? All this which is existential. And he gives that teaching specifically in connection with the constituents of the psychophysical organism, which is temporal, which is mortal, comes in, is born, proceeds, dies. See? So now, if we were to translate anatta as not atta, we can see that whilst atta is exactly the absolute, the atma of the Upanishads, anatta means that every time we mistake any part of the existential, the limited existent, the finite existent, as being immortal or absolute or belonging to the context of the transcendent, then we are making a mistake. It was the Buddha's way of saying neti neti, just as Yajnavalkya said, neti neti. Not this, not this. The body isn't immortal. It's not eternal. The feelings aren't. The thoughts aren't. The states of mind aren't. The deep states of consciousness also aren't. That. But that awareness which remains when the entire psyche is empty and mind itself is eaten up, so to say, Atma, you see, then there is the realization of transcendence, the realization by transcendence of its own transcendence, the realization by the infinite, the eternal and the immortal, through you, the finite and the mortal. And this is the marvelous thing about man and the possibility of man in mind and consciousness. So don't be bothered about no soul, no God. Leave the argumentation to those who would argue. you see. They enjoy it, all right, let them enjoy it. They'll keep on enjoying it till they are dead, perhaps, and then they'll be dead. And that's all about it. So be at peace, don't worry about it. Look at it that way, therefore, that all this, the finite existent, the existential, anything of it is not the transcendent, not the Atta, the absolute all. But there is a relationship. The absolute all, the transcendent context completely includes this, the existential. That is why it is possible for you as an existential, as a living existent, a particular existent, to be able to realize these states. All right? What a lot of time it takes. Now, come back to this primordial creative energy constantly active in eternity. This pulse of creation. And it's a rhythmic pulse. It is a discontinuous throb. It is everlastingly new. The entire universe is in being through the pulsation of this pulse of creation. This is the first meaning of the word karma. Now, as I said yesterday, I think, start from the other shore. Start from there. Now don't try to grasp it by mere logic. Let the words, if at all possible, without yourself forming pictures and concepts about it, let the words come to life and speak to you. And you will let them come to life if you are quiet. Quiet in your own mind. This pulse of creation is discontinuous, and the whole universe comes into being. The undifferentiated becomes the differentiated. You see? All right. Now, it is only in this supreme meditative state, and this is the real meditation. All that we go through in terms of the ordinary techniques of meditation is kindergarten. It's playing with things, learning by playing, the play way of learning. But this other is the living of the life way of learning. All right? From this state, as one, the state of utter unitary wholeness, as one gradually comes back to the ordinary state, because whilst we have a physical body, we have sooner or later, the Buddha generally says, after 7 days you come back to this state. And what a wise saying. I don't know whether he knew, as modern science knows, if you just stay absolutely still without eating or anything for more than 5 days, you will upset your nitrogen metabolism permanently. But they knew other things. All right. As you come back, what happens? The undifferentiated consciousness begins to differentiate, to proliferate. The one becomes two, becomes aware in terms of positive, negative, male, female, etc. That becomes three, because the interplay, the interaction, both in the material cosmos and in your own consciousness, produces the immaculate conception first, which gives birth to the virgin, a virgin birth. The Christ consciousness for the Christian the Buddha nature for the Buddhist, and so on, through the great teachings. Most of these, admittedly, are hidden. They are not open to everybody. And so, as this proliferation takes place, the many emerge out of the one. And in the early stages of this proliferation, it is in terms of what I like to call the archetypal forms of expression on the cosmic scale of the one primordial creative energy. And to these we give the names of the great archangels, the Amishaspans, also to the constructive and the destructive, not destructive, but destructive is a bad word, to the anabolic and catabolic processes of the living universe, you see. And they are called the angels and the devils and demons and so forth. But the demons are not demons in our sense of the word. They are indispensable for the universal process of becoming and the maintenance of the cosmos to take place. So proliferation takes place like that. Now, that primordial activity is the first meaning of karma. And I said, the pulse of creation, which works with, and this is the difficulty with words, incredible rapidity. But rapidity, the word rapidity, involves time and space, straight away. It involves time and space because we, being constituted as we are, cannot avoid being conscious and thinking in those terms. You know how Immanuel Kant, correct me if I'm wrong, it was he who said that these are the primary categories of mind, didn't he? Time and space are given, as it is said. But time-space is an integrated unity. The vijnana akasha infinity state. See, in a peculiar way, they realize that integration as such. So now, this pulse functions with incredible rapidity, and every time it functions, the entire cosmos is new. Now you'll say, but good gracious me, we see the thing, we look at it, and it is there the same. We come year after year, there are the same old trees and so forth. No, they are not the same old trees. My consciousness is such a sluggard, so slow to move, so dinosaurish, you see, that when my tail is bitten, it takes 2 weeks before my little brain knows the sensation, feels the sensation. You see, our consciousness is like that. Therefore, we see change taking place only as like we see a river moving. It is not like that. If you take a string and have some object burning like that, if you just move it slowly, it's all right. But supposing you twirl it at sufficient speed, you'll see a circle of fire. And if you haven't seen the previous state, supposing you are doing that and I come along and see, well, and I say, oh my goodness, look at that circle of fire. Until the person stops twirling it, and then I see that it is not a circle of fire. So you see, because our consciousness cannot keep pace with it, and we therefore see it in chunks, which because of we are constituted that way and we haven't the ability to do more, we say birth, growth, death. We cannot attend to it with that intensity, with that perfection, with that tremendous frequency of vibration which is required in order to be sufficiently in tune with it to see the separate, discontinuous throbbing and coming into being. Now, whilst the universe is new every time, with every single throb, it also, now this I can't explain in words at all, I've tried to find an explanation for about 4 or 5 years now, but I can't. That is to say, to find suitable words. The new state is not the consequence of the old state. And yet it is wholly and completely related to, it is subsumed in the primordial state. See? So karma works out fully, completely, from moment to moment. It does not need another life in the reincarnational sense to work itself out, where anything and everything is concerned. Now, we think in terms of your karma, my karma. Are you the sole responsible person for whatsoever you think, feel, speak, do? Think? Is there anything which happens as we can perceive it? We must always bear this limitation in mind. As far as we can perceive, is there anything which is isolatively, solely responsible? No. It's nothing at all. So, what sense is there? What meaning can there be in saying, oh, it is my karma. Yes, I am involved in it, but so is the rest of the universe. And thank God for modern science and its discoveries about the nature of the activity of the universal process. Today, since the last war, in the last 16 years, scientists have shown clearly, you can't know everything completely about any one thing unless and until you can know all about all its interrelations. And its interrelations are with the total cosmos. Now, it's true that this is a thought, if you like, an idea expressed as far as modern science expresses it, and it does it very well in an intelligible form. But if you brood over it carefully and let it convey its significance, you will begin to appreciate the fact that you and I live truly in a universe, a one thing. And the one thing functions and manifests in this extraordinary way. And because we can't be in tune with it exactly as it functions, therefore, we invent the idea of a separate entity, I am I. You see? And we have aspirations. Oh, I want to become this, I want to do that. And then as our sense of something greater than ourselves grows and we begin to get less and less self-enclosed and conceited and so forth, we want to serve mankind, to serve God, and all serve the purpose of our existence, fulfill it and so forth. All that comes into being. And we rear up a faulty system of wishful thought over it. So we invent our heavens and hells, which are all inside here and of our own making. You see? We invent our heavens and hells, or we invent reincarnation. I am I who will come back in some form or other to work out things and get better and better. Greed. Spiritual greed stands in the way. And this is one's own spiritual greed. But our environment has contributed to the emergence of that spiritual greed in no small measure. We don't know. I know how some of you seem to disbelieve me when I say One thing that I may claim really to know is that I don't know. This is the fact. I don't know. Perhaps that is why I talk so much. See, however, when we see this, we see that there is no such thing as the reincarnation of a changeless, permanent entity which is the identifiable I am I. All this interpretation of extraordinary phenomena which do take place, this children, for instance, children sort of suddenly say that at such and such a place this happened, that happened, they have no means of knowing it and so forth, and then investigations are made and it is found that yes, that happened, and this is interpreted as, oh, the child is remembering his past life. Why do we interpret it that way? Because the idea of reincarnation has already been thrust into us. Not otherwise. Those religions which flourish perfectly happily and well enough without rebirth and our limited ideas of karma and so forth, how is it that they have survived and are vigorous as Buddhism or Hinduism, which are the two main religions concerned with reincarnation and rebirth and karma and so forth? And the Greeks, of course, invented all sorts of ideas they used the word transmigration, metempsychosis, metensomatosis, palingenesis. All of which as ideas have a certain value if we can take to them, if we can study them in the right way, with an open mind, because they do help to make the mind more flexible. And as the mind becomes more flexible, it becomes more understanding, not just merely tolerant, which is often a condescending sufferance. And nothing else, you see. So, this idea of reincarnation, implying the changeless, permanent, finite entity, is a very misleading picture of what actually happens. This great cosmic pulse, this creative pulse working all the time, you see. And it is in the attempt in the profunda called the cessation of perception and feeling, which the Upanishads called the Turiya state or the fourth state. Turiya just means fourth, the ultimate or the ultimate state possible for man. They called it the Turiya, and they used the other words, the Jagrat, the Swapna, the dreaming consciousness state, and the Sushupti, the deep slumber consciousness state. Now, what on earth is the meaning of that? They deliberately used an ordinary physical phenomenon in order that not to cast their pearls before the wrong gentleman. Because what happens when this body goes to sleep? The brain still keeps monkeying about with the unworked out things during the daytime. And our dreams are spun out of that. But the grace of God or nature or whatever you like to call it, the grace of the cosmos is such that it allows us the deep slumber state too, the profoundly deep slumber state. And why is it that in that state we get recharged? there is no penetration or disturbance by desire, by fear, anxiety, or any sort of upsurge of personal ambition, the passion to impose oneself upon one's neighbors or upon a whole country, the people who have thought in terms of world conquest and so forth. Nothing like that intrudes upon that state. You are again in the truly harmless state, like the baby, like the infant sleeper. You see, the truly harmless state. And because one is in that truly harmless state, the whole living psychophysical organism is in rhythm with the whole living cosmos. And they throb in harmony. They work like members of an orchestra, if you like. See, therefore, this is recharged with energy from the primordial source of energy itself. But the karmic process works out completely. We can't see it. We just don't see it. We can only see it in sort of big chunks like that, because my own consciousness is so sluggish. That's all. But if through developing attentiveness one can begin to respond to the higher frequencies more and more completely, then the situation is different. Then one begins to feel and to see, yes, something like this happens. The only real rebirth which takes place is within our lifetime. Our self-association of the I am I consciousness with every single event, situation, circumstance, process, experience, and so forth, as it changes. It's this association of a postulated permanent entity, I am I. It's a fiction, you see. So it is this fictional self which reincarnates. If you like to use the word transmigration, a moving beyond, or a migration beyond, including everything, then perhaps as far as concepts and words are concerned, we may legitimately say the Supreme, the Absolute, the Lord, God, is the one and only transmigrant. How's that umpire? You are an umpire here.
Can I ask one thing, please? Without trying to be too controversial, on your description of the harmless state of a person who sleeps at night and then is in complete rhythm with this force. But there are occasions when people on awakening will want to discuss a dream experience or a fantasy or even a nightmare.
Oh, yes, yes.
So,
Because our sleep, the body's sleep, is composed of those two states. I mean, today science knows only too well that everybody's brain works in a state of turmoil for a certain period of your sleep. And there is a period when it is not in turmoil. That's the ordinary way. It may be that under extreme conditions, the person in his sleep is all the time in this turmoil of the brain state, although the body is asleep. The body remains asleep because the vigilance center has shut down completely for the whole period of the sleep. You see? so on. I don't know.
When you speak about this discontinuous pulse, which is terrific about, is it anything like an analogy with an electric light bulb, which I believe is going, in fact, in and out all the time, but it's acting so rapidly that we don't see it? An electric bulb, when it's light. I understand that it's going in and out so fast.
Yes.
It's continuous.
The oscillations or the sine waves of an electric light.
Yes, yes.
Could you liken it to that?
Well, analogies are helpful, but only up to a limited, only up to a point. We must beware of using analogies. If we are intelligent and understand that all analogies, although they are helpful to this, that or the other extent, they must never become fixations for understanding the actuality of the other thing.
It was the nearest thing I could think of.
Yes. But don't think too much in terms of... avoid thinking in terms of analogies. Use an analogy only when where intellectual feet begin to feel tired. Well, good folk, I am tired. So, we'll meet again tomorrow. I trust this has perhaps helped you just a little bit to understand. You see, I'm not denying the fundamental reality, truth, underlying what has been presented as reincarnation and rebirth and all the rest of it. But these are puerile ideas, reincarnation and rebirth. The whole of the Rig Veda has no mention of reincarnation. And that's the original religious document of the whole Indo-European race. There's no mention of it at all. You know, some years back, when was it, about 4 or 5 years back, I gave, by request, a special talk upon reincarnation and karma. You remember that?
Exactly.
And I presented it from the historical point of view, how the idea of reincarnation came into the Aryan rulers of India. The primitives, the proto-Australoids and the Negritos and so forth, had a belief in a life essence which was indestructible, which at my death went into the soil. And when it, after it went into the soil, it emerged again in plants and animals and so forth. And when a pregnant woman ate of that plant, vegetable or animal, then that life essence was manifested again. Now, after the Aryan-speaking peoples changed the political state of India from being just a collection of city-states with certain subsidiary elements, they had no real kingdoms or any such thing, and they established the kingdoms, they were in the minority, and the conquered, as usual, they had their own culture and in certain ways much more advanced than the very proud, haughty, Aryan-speaking people were. When they said, why are we like this now, toilers, hewers of wood and drawers of water, what have we done to deserve this and so forth. And the Aryan-speaking people found it convenient to take over this idea of the re-emergence of that indestructible life essence and built up a system of thought to pacify these people and help them to maintain law and order. They didn't have police and the apparatus of maintaining law and order that came into being in later centuries, much later. But this was convenient. Just as for the purely theistic religions, it was convenient to talk in terms of heaven and hell. You don't behave yourself, you'll burn forever. You behave yourself, you'll be a good chap, well, If you can't get into the front seats of the stalls, you will somewhere else, you see. So, fear, and so forth. This was a necessary external compulsive force in addition to that which is inherent in us, this moral imperative. And the natural experience of love, and I'm talking of man-woman love, and children. The animal side, all animals have this, you see. They are psychophysical creatures, had its part to play, and all these forces combined, and so it was so. I say law and order and the apparatus for it, but look at today. You see, these are the tragedies of human history. But we are very young, only 3 or 4 million years old. We probably have 1996 million years to go, unless we blow the earth up meanwhile.
It's possible.
Well, don't get frightened. We won't know anything about it if it does. Thank you so much.
Thank you.